you avoided that question rather well. Belgorath complimented him. The juggler smirked. Hey, thought so myself. Now, he continued seriously, as me ancient friend here says, 'tis not too likely that we'll be encountering the Candom if it rains, for a dog has usually the good sense to take to his kennel when the weather be foul, unless there be pressing need for him to be out and about. 'Tis far more probable for us to meet Temple Guardsman, for a knight, be he Erendish or Malorian, seems deaf to the gentle patter of rain on his armor. I shouldn't wonder that our young warrior king over there be of sufficient might to be a match for any guardsman we might meet alone. But there always be the possibility of coming across them in groups. Should there be such encounters, keep your wits about ye, and remember that once a knight has started his charge, 'tis very hard for him to swerve or change direction very much at all. A sidestep and a smart rap across the back of the head be usually enough to roll him out of the saddle. And a man in armor, once he's off his horse, be like a turtle on his back, don't you know?"
"You've done it a few times yourself, I take it," Soddy murmured.
"I've had me share of misunderstandings with Temple Guardsmen," Feldegast admitted. "And you'll note that I still be here to talk about 'em."
Durnick took the cast-iron pot Polgara had given him and set it in the center of their fire. After a time, he pulled it glowing out of the coals with a stout stick, placed the blade of a broken knife on a rounded rock, and then set the pot over it. He took up his axe, reversed it, and held the blunt end over the pot.
"You'll break it," Silk predicted. "Cast iron's too brittle to take any pounding."
"Trust me, Silk," the smith said with a wink.
He took a deep breath and began to tap lightly on the pot. The sound of his hammering was not the dull clack of cast iron, but the clear ring of steel, a sound that Geryon remembered from his earliest boyhood. Deftly, the smith reshaped the pot into a flat-topped helmet with a fierce nose guard and heavy cheek pieces. Geryon knew that his old friend was cheating just a bit by the faint whisper and surge he was directing at the emerging helmet. Then, Durnick dropped the helmet into a pail of water, where it hissed savagely, sending off a cloud of steam. The pot lid that the smith intended to convert into a shield, however, challenged even his ingenuity. It became quite obvious that, should he hammer it out to give it sufficient size to offer protection, it would be so thin that it would not even fend off a dagger stroke, much less a blow from a lance or sword. He considered that, even as he pounded on the ringing lid. He shifted his axe and made an obscure gesture at Toth. The giant nodded, went to the riverbank, returned with a pail full of clay, and dumped the bucket out in the center of the glowing shield. It gave off an evil hiss, and Durnick continued to pound.
Durnick, Geryon said, trying not to be impolite. A ceramic shield was not exactly what I had in mind, you know.
Durnick gave him a grin, filled with suppressed mirth.
Look at it, Geryon, he suggested, not changing the tempo of his hammering.
Geryon stared at the shield, his eyes suddenly wide. The glowing circle upon which Durnick was pounding was solid cherry-red steel.
How did you do that?
Transmutation, Polgara gasped.
Changing one thing into something else. Durnick, where on earth did you ever learn to do that?
Oh, it's just something I picked up, Paul, he laughed. As long as you've got a bit of steel to begin with, like that old knife blade, you can make as much more as you want out of anything that's handy, cast iron, clay, just about anything.
Sinedra's eyes had suddenly gone very wide.
Durnick, she said in almost a reverent whisper, could you have made it out of gold?
Durnick thought about it, still hammering.
I suppose I could have, he admitted. But gold's too heavy, and too soft to make a good shield, wouldn't you say?
Could you make another one?
She wheedled.
for me. It wouldn't have to be so big, at least not quite. Please, Durnick?
Durnick finished the rim of the shield with a shower of crimson sparks and the musical ring of steel on steel.
I don't think that would be a very good idea, said Nedra. Gold is valuable, because it's so scarce. If I stopped making it out of clay, it wouldn't be long before it wasn't worth anything at all. I'm sure you can see that.
But...
No, said Nedra, he said firmly.
Garion,
she appealed, her voice anguished. He is right, dear.
But...
Never mind, said Nedra.
The fire had burned down to a bed of glowing coals. Garion awoke with a start, sitting up suddenly. He was covered with sweat and trembling violently. Once again he had heard the wailing cry that he had heard the previous day, and the sound of it wrenched at his heart. He sat for a long time staring at the fire. In time, the sweat dried, and his trembling subsided. Zenedra's breathing was regular as she lay beside him, and there was no other sound in their well-shielded encampment. He rolled carefully out of his blankets and walked to the edge of the grove of cedars to stare bleakly out across the fields lying dark and empty under an inky sky. Then, because there was nothing he could do about it, he returned to his bed and slept fitfully until dawn. It was drizzling rain when he awoke. He got up and went out of the tent to join Durnick, who was building up the fire. "Can I borrow your axe?" he asked his friend. Durnick looked up at him. "I guess I'm going to need a lance to go with all of that." He looked rather distastefully at the helmet and shield, lying atop his mail shirt near the packs and saddles.
"Oh," the smith said. "Well, I almost forgot about that. Is one going to be enough? They break sometimes, you know. At least, Mander Allen's always did."
"I am certainly not going to carry more than one." Garion jabbed his thumb back over his shoulder at the hilt of his sword. "Anyway, I've always got this big knife to fall back on." The chill drizzle that had begun shortly before dawn was the kind of rain that made the nearby fields hazy and indistinct. After breakfast, they took heavy cloaks out of their packs and prepared to face a fairly unpleasant day. Garion had already put on his mail shirt, and he padded the inside of his helmet with an old tunic and jammed it down on his head. He felt very foolish as he clinked over to saddle Chrétien. The mail already smelled bad, and it seemed for some reason to attract the chill of the soggy morning. He looked at his new-cut lance and his round shield.
"Oh, this is going to be awkward," he said.
"Hang the shield from the saddle bow, Garion," Durnick suggested, "and set the butt of your lance in the stirrup beside your foot. Watch the way Mander Allen does it."
"I'll try it," Garion said. He hauled himself up into the saddle, already sweating under the weight of his mail. Durnick handed him the shield, and he hooked the strap of it over the saddle bow. Then he took his lance and jammed its butt into the stirrup, pinching his toes in the process.
"You'll have to hold it," the smith told him. "It won't stay upright by itself."
Garion grunted and took the shaft of his lance in his right hand.
"You look very impressive, dear,"
Zinedra assured him. "Wonderful," he replied dryly. They rode out of the cedar grove into the wet, miserable morning with Garion in the lead, feeling more than a little absurd in his warlike garb. The lance, he discovered almost immediately, had a stubborn tendency to dip its point toward the ground. He shifted his grip on it, sliding his hand up until he found its center of balance. The rain collected on the shaft of the lance, running down across his clammy hand and trickling into his sleeve. After a short while, a steady stream of water dribbled from his elbow.
"I feel like a downspout," he grumbled.
"Let's pick up the pace," Belgorath said to him.
It is a long way to Azshabah, and we do not have too much time. Geryon nudged Gretchen with his heels, and the big gray moved out, at first at a trot, and then in a rolling canter. For some reason, that made Geryon feel a bit less foolish. The road, which Feldegast had pointed out to them the previous evening, was little traveled, and this morning it was deserted. It ran past abandoned farmsteads, sad, bramble-choked shells, with the moldy remains of their thatched roofs all tumbled in. A few of the farmsteads had been burned, some only recently. The road began to turn muddy as the earth soaked up the steady rain. The cantering hooves of their horses splashed the mud up to coat their legs and bellies and to spatter the boots and cloaks of their riders. Silk rode beside Geryon, his sharp face alert. Just before they reached the crest of each hill, he galloped on ahead to have a quick look at the shallow valley lying beyond. By mid-morning, Geryon was soaked through, and he rode on bleakly, enduring the discomfort and the smell of new rust, wishing fervently that the rain would just stop. Silk came back down the next hill after scouting on ahead. His face was tight with a sudden excitement, and he motioned them all to stop. "There are some Grolums up ahead," he reported tersely. "How many?" Belgarath asked. "About 2 dozen. They're holding some kind of religious ceremony," the old man grunted. "Let's take a look." He looked at Geryon. "Leave your lance with Durnik," he said. "It sticks up too high into the air. I'd rather not attract attention." Geryon nodded and passed his lance over to the smith. Then he followed Silk, Belgarath, and Feldegast up the hill. They dismounted just before they reached the crest, and moved carefully to the top, where a brushy thicket offered some concealment. The black-robed Grolums were kneeling on the wet grass before a pair of grim altars some distance down the hill. A limp, unmoving form lay sprawled across each of them, and there was a great deal of blood. Sputtering braziers stood at the end of each altar, sending twin columns of black smoke up into the drizzle. The Grolums were chanting in the rumbling groan Geryon had heard too many times before. He could not make out what they were saying.
"Gandim?" Belgarath softly asked the juggler.
"It is hard to say for certain, ancient one," Feldegast replied. "The twin altars would suggest it. But the practice might have spread. Grolums be very quick to pick up the changes in church policy. But, Candom or not, 'twould be wise of us to avoid them. There be not much point in engaging ourselves in casual skirmishes with Grolums."
"There are trees over on the east side of the valley," Silk said, pointing. "If we stay in among them, we will be out of sight." Belgarath nodded. "How much longer are they likely to be praying?" Geryon asked.
Another half hour, at least," Feldegast replied.
Geryon looked at the pair of altars, feeling an icy rage building up in him. "I'd like to cap their ceremony with a little personal visit," he said.
"Forget it," Belgarath told him.
"You are not here to ride around the countryside righting wrongs. Let's go back and get the others. I'd like to get around these Grolums before they finish with their prayers." They picked their way carefully through the belt of dripping trees that wound along the eastern rim of the shallow valley where the Grolums were conducting their grim rites, and returned to the muddy road about a mile beyond. Again, they set out at the same distance eating canter, with Geryon once more in the lead. Some miles past the valley where the Grolums had sacrificed the two unfortunates, they passed a burning village that was spewing out clouds of black smoke. There seemed to be no one about, though there were some signs of fighting near the burning houses. They rode on, without stopping. The rain let up by mid-afternoon, though the sky remained overcast. Then, as they crested yet another hilltop on the rolling countryside, they saw another rider on the far side of the valley. The distance was too great to make out details, but Garion could see that the rider was armed with a lance.
"What do we do?"
he called back over his shoulder to the rest of them.
"That's why you are wearing armor and carrying a lance, Garion,"
Belgarath replied.
"Well, shouldn't I at least give him the chance to stand aside?"
"And to what purpose?" Feldegast asked. "You'll not do it. Your very presence here with your lance and your shield be a challenge, and he'll not be refusing it. Ride him down, young master. The day wears on, don't you know?"
"All right," Garion said unhappily.
He buckled his shield to his left arm, settled his helmet more firmly in place, and lifted the butt of his lance out of his stirrup. Gretchen was already pawing at the earth and snorting defiantly.
"Enthusiast," Garion muttered to him. "All right, let's go, then."
The big gray's charge was thunderous. It was not a gallop, exactly, nor a dead run, but rather was a deliberately implacable gait that could only be called a charge. The armored man across the valley seemed a little startled by the unprovoked attack, there having been none of the customary challenges, threats, or insults. After a bit of fumbling with his equipment, he managed to get his shield into place and his lance properly advanced. He seemed to be quite bulky, though that might have been his armor. He wore a sort of chainmail coat reaching to his knees. His helmet was round and fitted with a visor, and he had a large sword sheathed at his waist. He clanged down the visor, then sank his spurs into his horse's flanks and charged. The wet fields at the side of the road seemed to blur as Garion crouched behind his shield, with his lance lowered and aimed directly at his opponent. He had seen Mandarallan do this often enough to understand the basics. The distance between him and the stranger was narrowing rapidly, and Garion could clearly see the mud spraying out from beneath the hooves of his opponent's horse. At the last moment, just before they came together, Garion raised up in his stirrups as Mandarallan had instructed him, leaned forward so that his entire body was braced for the shock, and took careful aim with his lance at the exact center of the other man's shield. There was a dreadful crashing impact, and he was suddenly surrounded by flying splinters as his opponent's lance shattered. His own lance, however, though it was as stout as that of the guardsman, was a freshly cut cedar pole and was quite springy. It bent into a tight arc like a drawn bow, then suddenly snapped straight again. The startled stranger was suddenly lifted out of his saddle. His body described a high, graceful arc through the air, which ended abruptly as he came down on his head in the middle of the road. Garion thundered on past and finally managed to rein in his big gray horse. He wheeled and stopped. The other man lay on his back in the mud of the road. He was not moving. Carefully, his lance at the ready, Garion walked Gretchen back to the splinter-littered place where the impact had occurred.
"Are you all right?"
he asked the temple guardsman lying in the mud. There was no answer. Cautiously, Garion dismounted, dropped his lance, and drew Iron Grip's sword.
"I say, man, are you all right?"
he asked again. He reached out with his foot and nudged the fellow. The guardsman's visor was closed, and Garion put the tip of his sword under the bottom of it and lifted. The man's eyes were rolled back in his head until only the white showed, and there was blood gushing freely from his nose. The others came galloping up, and Senedra flung herself out of the saddle almost before her horse had stopped, hurling herself into her husband's arms.
"You were magnificent, Garion. Absolutely magnificent."
"It did go rather well, didn't it?"
he replied modestly, trying to juggle sword, shield, and his wife all at the same time. He looked at Polgra, who was also dismounting.
"Do you think he's going to be all right, Aunt Paul?" he asked. "I hope I didn't hurt him too much."
She checked the limp man lying in the road. "He will be fine, dear," she assured him.
He has just been knocked senseless, is all.
Oh, nice job, Silk said. Geryon suddenly grinned broadly.
You know something? I think I'm starting to understand Mandarallan and why he enjoys this so much. It is sort of exhilarating.
I think it has to do with the weight of the armor, Feldegast observed sadly to Belgorath. It bears down on them so much that it pulls all of the juice out of their brains, or some such.
Let's move on, Belgorath suggested.
By mid-morning the following day, they had moved into the broad valley which was the location of Malieska, the ecclesiastical capital of Meloria, and the site of the disciple Urvan's palace. Though the sky remained overcast, the rain had blown on through and a stiff breeze had begun to dry the grass and the mud which had clogged the roads. There were encampments dotting the valley, little clusters of people who had fled from the demons to the north and the plague to the south. Each group was fearfully isolated from its neighbors, and all of them kept their weapons close to hand. Unlike those of Malrakut, the gates of Malieska stood open, though they were patrolled by detachments of mail-armored temple guardsmen.
"Why don't they go into the city?"
Durnik asked, looking at the clusters of refugees.
"Malieska's not the sort of place you visit willingly, good man,"
Feldegast replied.
"When the Grolems be looking for people to sacrifice on their altars, 'tis unwise to make yourself too handy."
He looked at Belgorath.
"Would you be willing to accept a suggestion, me ancient friend?"
"Suggest away."
"We'll be needing information about what's happening up there."
He pointed at the snow-capped mountains looming across the northern horizon.
"Since I know me way about Malieska, and know how to avoid the Grolems, wouldn't you say that it might be worth the investment of an hour or so to have me nose out about the central marketplace and see what news I can pick up?"
"He has got a point, Belgorath," Silk agreed seriously. "I don't like riding into a situation blind."
Belgorath considered it.
"All right," he said to the juggler. "But be careful, and stay out of the alehouses,"
Feldegast sighed.
"There be no such havens in Malieska, Belgorath. The Grolems there be fearful strict in their disapproval of the simple pleasures."
He shook the reins of his mule and rode on across the plain toward the black walls of Irvan's capital.
"Isn't he contradicting himself?" Zadi asked. "First he says it is too dangerous to go into the city. Then he rides on anyway."
"He knows what he is doing," Belgorath said. "He is in no danger."
"We might as well have some lunch while we are waiting, father," Belgorath suggested.
He nodded, and they rode some distance into an open field and dismounted. Geryon laid aside his lance, pulled his helmet from his sweaty head, and stood looking out across the intervening open space at the center of church power in Meloria. The city was large, certainly, though not nearly so large as Malzeth. The walls were high and thick, surmounted by heavy battlements, and the towers rising inside were square and blocky. There was a kind of unrelieved ugliness about it, and it seemed to exude a brooding menace, as if the aeons of cruelty and bloodlust had sunk into its very stone. From somewhere, near the center of the city, the telltale black column of smoke rose into the air, and, faintly echoing across the plain, with its huddled encampments of frightened refugees, he thought he could hear the sullen iron clang of the gong coming from the Temple of Torak. Finally, he sighed and turned his head away.
"It will not last forever,"
Eriand, who had come up beside him, had said firmly.
"We are almost to the end of it now. All of the altars will be torn down, and the Grolems will put their knives away to rust."
They ate a cold lunch, and, not long after, Feldegast returned, his face somber.
"'Tis perhaps a bit more serious than we had expected, Ancient One,' he reported, swinging down from his mule. "'The Kingdom be in total control of the city, and the Temple Guardsmen be taking their orders directly from them. The Grolem to hold to the old ways have all gone into hiding, but packs of Torax hounds be sniffing out the places where they've hidden, and they be tearing them to pieces wherever they find them.
"'I find it very hard to sympathize with Grolems,' Zadi murmured.
"'I can bear their discomfort myself,' Feldegast agreed. "'But 'tis rumored about the marketplace that the Candle and their dogs, and their guardsmen also be moving, about across the border into Katakor.
"'In spite of the Karans and Menga's demons?' Silk asked with some surprise.
"'No. That's something I could not get the straight of,' the juggler replied. "'No one could tell me why or how, but the Kingdom and their guardsmen seem not to be concerned about Menga, nor his army, nor his demons.'
"'That begins to smell of some kind of accommodation,' Silk said.
"'There were hints of that previously,' Feldegast reminded him.
"'An alliance?' Belgarath frowned.
"'It is hard to say for sure, Ancient One. But Irvan be a schemer, and he always had this dispute with the Imperial Throne at Malzeth. If he has managed to put Menga in his pocket, Khal Zakath had better look to his defenses.'
"'Is Irvan in the city?' Belgarath asked.
"'No. No one knows where he's gone for sure, but he's not in this palace there.'
"'Well, that's very strange,' Belgarath said.
"'Indeed,' the juggler replied. "'But whatever he's doing or planning to do, I think we'd better be walking softly once we cross the border into Katakor. When you add the hounds and the temple guardsmen to the demons and Korans there, 'tis going to be fearful perilous to approach the house of Torak at Ashabah.'
"'That is a chance we shall have to take,' the old man said grimly. "'We are going to Ashabah, and if anything, hound, human, or demon, gets in our way, well, we'll just have to deal with it as it comes to us.'"
Chapter 15. The sky continued to lower as they rode past the brooding city of the Grolem Church, under the suspicious gaze of the armored guardsmen at the gate and the hooded Grolems on the walls.
"'Is it likely that they'll follow us?' Durnik asked.
"'It's not very probable, goodman,' Zadi replied. "'Look around you. There are thousands encamped here, and I doubt that either guardsmen or Grolems would take the trouble to follow them all when they leave.'
"'I suppose you're right,' the smith agreed.
By late afternoon, they were well past Malyaska, and the snow-topped peaks of Katakor loomed higher ahead of them. The mountains were starkly outlined against the dirty gray clouds scudding in from the west.
"'Will you be wanting to stop for the night before we cross the border?'
Feldegast asked Belgarath.
"'How far is it there from here?'
"'Oh, not far at all, Ancient One.'
"'Is it guarded?'
"'Usually, yes.'
"'Silk,' the old man said.
"'Ride on ahead and have a look.'
The little man nodded and nudged his horse into a gallop.
"'All right,'
Belgarath said, signaling for a halt so that they could all hear him.
"'Everybody we have seen this afternoon was going south. Nobody's fleeing toward Katakor.' Now a man who is running away from some place does not stop when the border is in sight. He keeps on going. That means that there's a fair chance that there is not going to be anybody within miles of the border on the Katakor side. If the border is not guarded, we can just go on across and take shelter for the night on the other side.
"And if the border is guarded?" Tzadi asked.
Belgarath's eyes grew flat.
"We are still going to go through."
"That's likely to involve fighting."
"That's right. Let's move along, shall we?"
About 15 minutes later, Silk returned.
"There are about 10 guardsmen at the crossing," he reported.
"Any chance of taking them by surprise?"
Belgarath asked him.
"A little. But the road leading to the border is straight and flat for half a mile on either side of the guard post."
The old man muttered a curse under his breath.
"All right, then. They'll at least have time to get to their horses. We don't want to give them the leisure to get themselves set. Remember what Feldegast said about keeping your wits. Don't take any chances. But I want all of those guardsmen on their backs after our first charge. Paul, you stay back with the ladies and Eriond."
"But..." Velvet began to protest.
"Do not argue with me, Lyselle, just this once."
"Couldn't Lady Polgarah just put them to sleep?" Tzadi asked. "The way she did with the spies back in Malzeth."
Belgarath shook his head. "There are a few Grolems among the guardsmen, and that particular technique does not work on Grolems. This time we are going to have to do it by main strength, just to be on the safe side."
Tzadi nodded glumly, dismounted and picked up a stout tree limb from the side of the road. He thumped it experimentally on the turf.
"I want you all to know that this is not my preferred way of doing things," he said.
The rest of them also dismounted and armed themselves with cudgels and staffs. Then they moved on. The border was marked by a stone shed painted white and by a gate consisting of a single white pole resting on posts on either side of the road. A dozen horses were tethered just outside of the shed, and lances leaned against the wall. A single, mail-coated guardsman paced back and forth across the road on the near side of the gate, his sword leaning back over his shoulder.
"All right," Belgarath said. "Let's move as fast as we can. Wait here, Paul."
Geryon sighed. "I guess I'd better go first."
"We were hoping that you would volunteer."
Silk's grin was tight. Geryon ignored it. He buckled on his shield, settled his helmet into place, and once again lifted the butt of his lance out of the stirrup.
"Is everybody ready?"
he asked, looking around. Then he advanced his lance and spurred his horse into a charge, with the others close on his heels. The guardsmen at the gate took one startled look at the warlike party bearing down on him, ran to the door of the shed, and shouted at his comrades inside. Then he struggled into the saddle of his tethered horse, leaned over to pick up his lance, and moved out onto the road. Other guardsmen came boiling out of the shed, struggling with their equipment and stumbling over each other. Geryon had covered half the distance to get to the gate before more than 2 or 3 of the armored men were in their saddles. And so it was that the man who had been standing watch was forced to meet his charge alone. The results were relatively predictable. As Geryon thundered past his unhorsed opponent, another guardsman came out into the road at half a gallop. But Geryon gave him no time to set himself or to turn his horse. The crashing impact against the unprepared man's shield hurled his horse from its feet. The guardsman came down before the horse did, and the animal rolled over him, squealing and kicking with fright. Geryon tried to rein in, but Kretchen had the bit in his teeth. He cleared the pole gate in a long, graceful leap and charged on. Geryon swore and gave up on the reins. He leaned forward and seized the big gray by one ear and hauled back. Startled, Kretien stopped so quickly that his rump skidded on the road.
"The fight's back that way," Geryon told his horse. "Or did you forget already?"
The horse gave him a reproachful look, turned, and charged back toward the gate again. Because of the speed of their attack, Geryon's friends were on top of the guardsmen before the armored men could bring their lances into play, and the fight had quickly turned ugly. Using the blunt side of his axe,
Durnick smashed in one guardsman's visor, denting it so severely that the man could no longer see. He rode in circles helplessly, both hands clutching at his helmet, until he rode under a low-hanging limb, which smoothly knocked him off of his horse. Silk ducked under a wide backhand sword stroke, reached down with his dagger, and neatly cut his attacker's girth strap. The fellow's horse leaped forward, jumping out from under its rider. Saddle and all, the guardsman tumbled into the road. He struggled to his feet, sword in hand, but Feldegast came up behind him and methodically clubbed him to the earth again with an ugly lead mace. It was Toth, however, who was the hardest pressed. Three guardsmen closed in on the giant. Even as Kretchen leaped the gate again, Geryon saw the huge man awkwardly flailing with his staff for all the world, like someone who had never held one in his hands before. When the three men came within range, however, Toth's skill miraculously reemerged. His heavy staff whirled in a blurring circle. One guardsman fell wheezing to the earth, clutching at his broken ribs. Another doubled over sharply as Toth deftly poked him in the pit of his stomach with the butt of his staff. The third desperately raised his sword, but the giant casually swiped it out of his hand, then reached out and took the surprised man by the front of his mail coat. Geryon clearly heard the crunch of crushed steel as Toth's fist closed. Then the giant looked about and almost casually threw the armored man against a roadside tree so hard that it shook the spring leaves from the highest twigs. The three remaining guardsmen began to fall back, trying to give themselves room to use their lances, but they seemed unaware that Geryon was returning to the fray from behind them. As Kretchen thundered toward the unsuspecting trio, a sudden idea came to Geryon. Quickly, he turned his lance sideways so that its center rested just in front of his saddle bow and crashed into the backs of the guardsmen. The springy cedar pole swept all three of them out of their saddles and over the heads of their horses. Before they could stumble to their feet, Tzadi, Feldegast, and Durnick were on them, and the fight ended as quickly as it had begun.
"I don't think I've ever seen anybody use a lance that way before," Silk said gaily to Geryon.
"I just made it up," Geryon replied with an excited grin. "Oh, I'm sure that there are at least a half dozen rules against it."
"We probably shouldn't mention it, then."
"I won't tell anybody, if you don't."
Durnick was looking around critically. The ground was littered with guardsmen who were either unconscious or groaning over assorted broken bones. Only the man Toth had poked in the stomach was still in his saddle, though he was doubled over, gasping for breath. Durnick rode up to him.
"Excuse me," he said politely, removed the poor fellow's helmet, and then rapped him smartly on top of the head with the butt of his axe.
The guardsman's eyes glazed, and he toppled limply out of the saddle. Belgarath suddenly doubled over, howling with laughter.
"Excuse me?" he demanded of the smith. "Well, there's no need to be uncivil to people, Belgarath," Durnick replied stiffly.
Polgra came riding sedately down the hill, followed by Tsinedra, Velvet, and Eriond.
"Very nice, gentlemen," she complimented them all, looking around at the fallen guardsmen. Then she rode up to the pole gate. "Geryon, dear," she said pleasantly, reining in her mount, "would you mind?"
He laughed, rode Kretchen over to the gate, and kicked it out of her way.
"Why on earth were you jumping fences in the very middle of the fight?" she asked him curiously.
"It was not altogether my idea," he replied.
"Oh," she said, looking critically at the big horse. "I think I understand."
Kretchen managed somehow to look slightly ashamed of himself. They rode on past the border as evening began imperceptibly to darken an already gloomy sky. Feldegast pulled in beside Belgarath.
"Would your morals be at all offended if I was to suggest sheltering for the night in a snug little smuggler's cave I know of, a few miles or so farther on?"
Belgarath grinned and shook his head. "Not in the slightest. When I need a cave,
I never concern myself about the previous occupants. And then he laughed. I shared quarters for a week once with a sleeping bear. Nice enough bear, actually, once I got used to his snoring. 'Tis a fascinating story, I'm sure, and I'd be delighted to hear it. But the night's coming on, and you can tell me about it over supper. Shall we be off, then?
The juggler thumped his heels into his mule's flanks and led them on up the rutted road in the rapidly descending twilight at a jolting gallop. As they moved into the first of the foothills, they found the poorly maintained road lined on either side by mournful-looking evergreens. The road, however, was empty, though it showed signs of recent heavy traffic. All headed south.
"How much farther to this cave of yours?" Belgrath called to the juggler.
"'Tis not far, ancient one," Feldegast assured him. "There be a dry ravine that crosses the road up ahead, and we can go up that a bit of the ways, and there we are."
"I hope you know what you are doing."
"Trust me."
Somewhat surprisingly, Belgrath let that pass. They pounded on up the road as a sullen dusk settled into the surrounding foothills, and deep shadows began to gather about the trunks of the evergreens.
"Ah, and there it is," Feldegast said, pointing at the rocky bed of a dried-up stream. "The footin' be treacherous here, so we'd best lead the mounts."
He swung down from his mule and cautiously began to lead the way up the ravine. It grew steadily darker, the light fading quickly from the overcast sky. As the ravine narrowed and rounded a sharp bend, the juggler rummaged through the canvas pack strapped to the back of his mule. He lifted out the stub of a candle and looked at Durnick.
"Can you be making me a bit of a flame, goodman?" he asked. "I'd do it myself, but I seem to have misplaced me tinder."
Durnick opened his pouch, took out his flint and steel, and a wad of tinder. After several tries, he blew a lighted spark into a tiny finger of fire. He held it out, shielded between his hands, and Feldegast lit his bit of candle.
"Ah, and here it is now," the juggler said grandly, holding up his candle to illuminate the steep banks of the ravine.
"Where?" Silk asked, looking about in puzzlement.
"Well, now, Prince Keldar, it wouldn't be much of a hidden cave if the opening was out in plain sight for just anybody to stumble across, now would it?"
Feldegast went over to the steep side of the ravine, where a huge slab of water-scored granite leaned against the bank. He lowered his candle, shielding it with his hand and bending slightly. He disappeared behind it with his mule trailing along behind him. The interior of the cave was floored with clean white sand, and the walls had been worn smooth by centuries of swirling water. Feldegast stood in the center of the cave holding his candle aloft. There were crude log bunks along the walls, a table, some benches in the center of the cave, and a rough fireplace near the far wall with a fire already laid. Feldegast crossed to the fireplace, bent, and lit the kindling lying under the split logs resting on a rough stone grate.
"Well, now that's better," he said, holding his hands out to the crackling flames. "Isn't this a cozy little haven?"
Just beyond the fireplace was an archway, in part natural, and in part the work of human hands. The front of the archway was closed off with several horizontal poles. Feldegast pointed at it.
"There be the stable for the horses, and also a small spring at the back of it. 'Tis altogether the finest smuggler's cave in this part of Meloria."
"A cunning sort of place," Belgarath agreed, looking around.
"What do they smuggle through here?" Silk asked, with a certain professional curiosity.
"Gemstones, for the most part. There be rich deposits in the cliffs of Ketikor, and quite often whole gravel bars of the shiny little darlings lying in the streams to be had for the trouble it takes to pick 'em up. The local taxes be notoriously cruel, though, so the bold lads in this part of these mountains have come up with various ways to take their goods across the border without disturbing the sleep of the hard-working tax collectors.
Polgaro was inspecting the fireplace. There were several iron pothooks protruding from its inside walls, and a large iron grill sitting on stout legs to one side.
Very nice, she murmured approvingly. Is there adequate firewood? More than enough, me dear lady, the juggler replied. 'Tis stacked in the stable, along with fodder for the horses.
Well, then, she said, removing her blue cloak and laying it across one of the bunks,
I think I might be able to expand the menu I had planned for this evening's meal. As long as we have such complete facilities here, it seems a shame to waste them. I will need more firewood stacked here, and water, of course.
She went to the pack horses that carried her cooking utensils and her stores, humming softly to herself. Durnick, Toth, and Ariond led the horses into the stable and began to unsaddle them. Geryon, who had left his lance outside, went to one of the bunks, removed his helmet, and laid it, along with his shield, under the bunk. As he began to struggle out of his mail shirt, Tsinedra came over to assist him.
"You were magnificent today, dear,"
she told him warmly. He grunted noncommittally, leaning forward and extending his arms over his head so that she could pull the shirt off. She tugged hard, and the mail shirt came free all at once. Thrown off balance by the weight, she sat down heavily on the sandy floor with the shirt in her lap. Geryon laughed and quickly went to her.
"Oh, Tsinedra," he said, still laughing, "I do love you."
He kissed her, and then helped her to her feet.
"This is terribly heavy, isn't it?"
she said, straining to lift the steel link shirt.
"Oh, you noticed," he said, rubbing at one aching shoulder. "And here you thought I was just having fun."
"Be nice, dear. Do you want me to hang it up for you?"
He shrugged. "I'll just kick it under the bunk." Her look was disapproving. "I don't think it's going to wrinkle, Tsinedra."
"But it is untidy to do it that way, dear."
She made some effort to fold the thing, then gave up, rolled it into a ball, and pushed it far back under the bunk with her foot. Supper that evening consisted of thick steaks cut from a ham that Vela had provided to them, a rich soup so thick that it hovered on the very edge of stew. Large slabs of bread had been warmed before the fire. They finished with baked apples with honey and cinnamon. After they had eaten, Polgara rose and looked around the cave again.
"The ladies and I are going to need a bit of privacy now," she said, "and several basins of hot water."
Belgarath sighed.
"Again, Paul?"
"Yes, father. It is time to clean up and change clothes. For all of us," she pointedly sniffed at the air in the small cave.
"Yes, it's definitely time." They curtained off a portion of the cave to give Polgara, Tsinedra, and Velvet the privacy they required, and began heating water over the fire. Though at first reluctant to even move, Geryon had to admit that after he had washed up and changed into clean, dry clothes, he did feel much better. He sat back on one of the bunks beside Tsinedra, not even particularly objecting to the damp smell of her hair. He had that comfortable sense of being clean, well-fed, and warm, after a day spent out of doors in bad weather. He was, in fact, right on the edge of dozing off when there echoed up the narrow ravine outside a vast bellow that seemed to be part animal and part human, a cry so dreadful that it chilled his blood, making the hair rise on the back of his neck.
"What is that?"
Tsinedra exclaimed with fright.
"Hush now, girl," Feldegast warned softly.
He jumped to his feet and quickly secured a piece of canvas across the opening of the fireplace, plunging the cave into near darkness. Another soulless bellow echoed up the ravine. The sound seemed filled with a dreadful malevolence.
"Can we put a name to whatever it is?" Zadi asked with a quiet voice.
"It's nothing I've ever heard before," Dernek assured him.
"I think I have," Belgarath said bleakly. "When I was in Morinland, there was a magician up there who thought it was amusing to turn his demon out at night to hunt. It made a sound like that."
"What an unsavory practice," the eunuch murmured. "What do demons eat?"
"You really wouldn't want to know," Silk replied. He turned to Belgarath. "Would you care to hazard a guess at just how big that thing might be?"
"It varies. From the amount of noise it is making, though, I would say that it's fairly large."
"Then it would not be able to get into this cave, would it?"
"Well, that's a gamble I think I'd rather not take."
"It can sniff out our tracks, I assume." The old man nodded. "The things are definitely going to pieces here, Belgarath. Can you do anything at all to drive it off?" The little man turned to Polgara. "Or perhaps you, Polgara. You dealt with a demon Kavat raised back in the harbor at Rakurga." "I had help, Silk," she reminded him. "Aldor came to my aid." Belgarath began to pace up and down, scowling at the floor.
"Well," Silk pressed. "Don't rush me," the old man growled. "I might be able to do something," he said grudgingly. "But if I do, it is going to make so much noise that every Grolem and Katakor is going to hear it, and probably Zandramas as well. We will have the Kandam or her Grolems hot on our heels all the way to Asheba."
"Why not use the orb?"
Eriond suggested, looking up from the bridle he was repairing.
"Because the orb makes even more noise than I do. If Geryon uses the orb to chase off a demon, they are going to hear it in Gandahar all the way on the other side of the continent."
"But it would work, wouldn't it?"
Belgarath looked at Polgara.
"I think he's right, Father. A demon would flee from the orb, even if it were fettered by its master. An unfettered demon would flee even faster."
"Can you think of anything else?"
A god," she shrugged. "All demons, no matter how powerful, flee from gods. Do you happen to know any gods?"
"A few, but they're busy right now."
Another shattering bellow resounded through the mountains. It seemed to come from right outside the cave.
"It's time for some kind of decision, old man," Silk said urgently.
"It's the noise the orb makes that bothers you?"
Eriond asked. "That, and the light. That blue beacon that lights up every time Geryon draws the sword attracts a lot of attention, you know."
"You aren't all suggesting that I fight a demon, are you?"
Geryon demanded indignantly. "Of course not," Belgarath snorted. "Nobody fights a demon. Nobody can. All we are discussing is the possibility of driving it off."
He began to pace up and down again, scuffing his feet in the sand.
"I hate to announce our presence here," he muttered.
Outside, the demon bellowed again, and the huge granite slab partially covering the cave mouth began to grate back and forth, as if some huge force were rocking it, trying to move it aside.
"Our options are running out, Belgarath," Silk told him. "And so is our time. If you don't do something quickly, that thing is going to be in here with us." "Try not to pinpoint our location to the Grolems," Belgarath said to Geryon.
"You really want me to go out there and do it?"
"Of course I do. Silk was right. Time is running out on us."
Geryon went to his bunk and fished his mail shirt out from under it.
"You won't need that. It wouldn't do any good anyway."
Geryon reached over his shoulder and drew his great sword. He set its point in the sand and peeled the soft leather sheath from its hilt.
"I think this is a mistake," he declared.
Then he reached out and put his hand on the orb.
"Let me, Geryon,"
Eriond said. He rose, came over, and covered Geryon's hand with his own.
Geryon gave him a startled look.
"It knows me, remember?"
the young man explained.
"And I've got a sort of an idea."
A peculiar tingling sensation ran through Geryon's hand and arm, and he became aware that Eriond was communing with the orb in a manner even more direct than he himself was capable of. It was as if, during the month that the boy had been the bearer of the orb, the stone had, in some peculiar way, taught him its own language. There was a dreadful scratching coming from the mouth of the cave, as if huge talons were clawing at the stone slab.
"Be careful out there," Belgarath cautioned. "Don't take any chances. Just hold up the sword, so that it can see it. The orb should do the rest."
Geryon sighed.
"All right," he said, moving toward the cave mouth with Eriond directly behind him.
"Where are you going?" Polgara asked the blonde young man.
"With Belgarion," Eriond replied. "We both need to talk with the orb to get this right. I'll explain it later, Polgara."
The slab at the cave mouth was rocking back and forth again. Geryon ducked quickly out from behind it and ran several yards up the ravine with Eriond on his heels. Then he turned and held up the sword.
"Not yet,"
Eriond warned.
"It hasn't seen us."
There was an overpoweringly foul odor in the ravine, and then, as Geryon's eyes slowly adjusted to the darkness, he saw the demon outlined against the clouds, rolling in overhead. It was enormous. Its shoulders blotted out half of the sky. It had long, pointed ears like those of a vast cat, and its dreadful eyes burned with a green fire, casting a fitful glow across the floor of the ravine. It bellowed and reached toward Geryon and Eriond with a great, scaly claw.
"Now, Belgarion,"
Eriond said quite calmly. Geryon lifted his arms, holding his sword directly in front of him, with its point aimed at the sky, and then he released the curbs he had placed on the orb. He was not in the least prepared for what happened. A huge noise shook the earth and echoed off the nearby hills, causing giant trees miles away to tremble. Not only did the great blade take fire, but the entire sky suddenly shimmered in an intense sapphire blue, as if it had been ignited. Blue flame shot from horizon to horizon, and the vast sound continued to shake the earth. The demon froze, its vast, tooth-studded muzzle turned upward to the blazing blue sky in terror. Grimly, Geryon advanced on the thing, still holding his burning sword before him. The beast flinched back from him, trying to shield its face from the intense blue light. It screamed as if it suddenly was gripped by an intolerable agony. It stumbled back, falling and scrambling to its feet again. Then it took one more look at that blazing sky, turned and fled howling back down the ravine with a peculiar loping motion as all four of its claws tore at the earth.
"That is your idea of quiet?" Belgarath thundered from the cave mouth. "And what was all of that?"
He pointed a trembling finger at the still illuminated sky.
"It's really all right, Belgarath,"
Eriond told the infuriated old man.
"You didn't want the sound to lead the Grolems to us, so we just made it general through the whole region. Nobody could have pinpointed its source."
Belgarath blinked, then frowned for a moment.
"What about all of the light?"
he asked in a more mollified tone of voice.
"It's more or less the same with that," Eriond explained calmly. "If you have got a single blue fire in the mountains on a dark night, everybody can see it. If the whole sky catches on fire, though, nobody can really tell where it's coming from."
"It does sort of make sense, Grandfather," Geryon said.
"Are they all right, Father?"
Polgara asked from behind the old man.
"What could possibly have hurt them? Geryon can level mountains with that sword of his. He very nearly did, as a matter of fact. The whole Kerendi's range rang like a bell."
He looked up at the still flickering sky.
"Can you turn that off?"
"Oh,"
Geryon said. He reversed his sword and resheathed it in the scabbard strapped across his back. The fire in the sky died.
We really had to do it that way, Belgarath,
Eriand continued.
We needed the light and the sound to frighten off the demon, and we had to do it in such a way that the Grolems couldn't follow it, so...
He spread both hands and shrugged.
Did you know about this?
Belgarath asked Geryon.
Well, of course, Grandfather.
Geryon lied. Belgarath grunted.
All right, come back inside, he said.
Geryon bent slightly toward Arion's ear.
Why didn't you tell me what we were going to do? There wasn't really any time, Belgarion.
The next time we do something like that, take time. I almost dropped the sword when the ground started shaking under me.
Oh, that wouldn't have been a very good idea at all.
I know. A fair number of rocks had been shaken from the ceiling of the cave and lay on the sandy floor. Dust hung thickly in the air.
What happened out there? Silk demanded in a shaky voice.
Oh, not much, Geryon replied in a deliberately casual voice. We just chased it away, that's all.
There was not really any help for it, I guess, Belgarath said. But just about everybody in Katakor knows that something is moving around in these mountains, so we are going to have to start being very careful.
How much farther is it to Ashaba? Zadi asked him.
About a day's ride.
Will we make it in time?
Only just. So let's all get some sleep.
Geryon had the same dream again that night. He was not really sure that it was a dream, since dreaming usually involved sight as well as sound. But all there was to this one was that persistent, despairing wail and the sense of horror with which it filled him. He sat up on his bunk, trembling and sweat-covered. After a time, he drew his blanket about his shoulders. He stared at the ruddy coals in the fireplace until he dozed off again. It was still cloudy the following morning, and they rode cautiously back down the ravine to the rutted track leading up into the foothills of the mountains. Silk and Feldegast ranged out in front of them as scouts to give them warning should any dangers arise. After they had ridden a league or so, the pair came back down the narrow road. Their faces were sober, and they motioned for silence.
"There's a group of Kerans camped around the road up ahead," Silk reported in a voice scarcely louder than a whisper.
"An ambush?" Zadi asked him.
"No," Feldegast replied in a low voice.
"They're asleep for the most part. From the look of things, I'd say that they spent the night in some sort of religious observance, and so they're probably exhausted or still drunk."
"Can we get around them?" Belgarath asked.
"It shouldn't be too much trouble," Silk replied. "We can just go off into the trees and circle around until we're past the spot where they're sleeping."
The old man nodded. "Lead the way."
They left the road and angled off into the timber, moving at a cautious walk.
"What sort of ceremony were they holding?" Durnik asked quietly.
Silk shrugged.
"It looked pretty obscure," Silk told him. "They've got an altar set up with skulls on posts along the back of it. There seems to have been quite a bit of drinking going on, as well as some other things."
"What sort of things?"
Silk's face grew slightly pained.
"They have women with them," he answered disgustedly. "There is some evidence that things got a bit indiscriminate."
Durnik's cheeks suddenly turned bright red.
"Aren't you exaggerating a bit, Keldar?"
Velvet asked him.
"No, not really. Some of them were still celebrating."
"But a bit more important than quaint local religious customs, though," Feldegast added, still speaking quietly, "be the peculiar pets the Kerans was keeping."
"Pets?" Belgarath asked.
"Perhaps 'tis not the right word, ancient one, but sittin' round the edges of the camp was a fair number of the hounds, and they was making no move to devour the celebrants."
Belgarath looked at him sharply. "Are you sure?"
"I've seen enough of the hounds of Torak to recognize 'em when I see 'em.
So, there is some kind of an alliance between Menga and Ervan, the old man said.
Your wisdom is altogether a marvel, old man. It must be a delight beyond human imagination to have the benefit of 10,000 years' experience to guide ye in coming to such conclusions.
7,000, Belgarath corrected.
7, 10, what matter?
7,000, Belgarath repeated with a slightly offended expression. Chapter 16. They rode that afternoon into a dead wasteland, a region foul and reeking, where white snags poked the skeleton-like fingers of their limbs imploringly at a dark and roiling sky, where dank ponds of oily, stagnant water exuded the reek of decay. Clots of fungus lay in gross profusion about the trunks of long dead trees, and matted down weeds struggled up through ashy soil toward a sunless sky.
It looks almost like Stolmishrak, doesn't it? Silk asked, looking about distastefully.
We're getting very close to Ashaba, Belgarath told him. Something about Torek did this to the ground.
Didn't he know?
Velvet said sadly.
Know what?
Zinedra asked her.
That his very presence befouled the earth. No,
Zinedra replied.
I don't think he did. His mind was so twisted that he couldn't even see it. The sun hid from him, and he saw that only as a mark of his power, and not as a sign of its repugnance for him.
It was a peculiarly astute observation which to some degree surprised Geryon. His wife oftentimes seemed to have a wide streak of giddiness in her nature, which made it far too easy to think of her as a child. A misconception, reinforced by her diminutive size. But he had frequently found it necessary to reassess this tiny, often willful little woman who shared his life. Zinedra might sometimes behave foolishly, but she was never stupid. She looked out at the world with a clear, unwavering vision that saw much more than gowns and jewels and costly perfumes. Quite suddenly, he was so proud of her that he thought his heart would burst.
"How much farther is it to Ashaba?" Zadi asked in a subdued tone. "I hate to admit it, but this particular swamp depresses me."
"You?" Ternik said.
"Oh, I thought you liked swamps."
"A swamp should be green and rich with life, Goodman. There's nothing here but death." He looked at Velvet.
"Have you got Zith, Margrelaine?"
he asked rather plaintively.
"I'm feeling a bit lonesome just now."
"She's sleeping at the moment, Zadi,"
she told him, her hand going to the front of her bodice in an oddly protective fashion.
"She's safe and warm and very content. She's even purring."
"Resting in her perfumed little bower," he sighed. "There are times when I envy her."
"Why, Zadi,"
she said, blushing slightly, lowering her eyes and then flashing her dimples at him.
"Merely a clinical observation, my dear Lascelles," he said to her rather sadly. "There are times when I wish it could be otherwise, but—"
and he sighed again. "Do you really have to carry that snake there?" Silk asked the blonde girl.
"Yes, Keldar,"
she replied.
"As a matter of fact, I do."
"You did not answer my question, Ancient One," Zadi said to Belgarath. "How much farther is it to Ashaba?"
"It is up there," the sorcerer replied, pointing toward a ravine angling sharply up from the reeking wasteland. "We should make it by dark."
"A particularly unpleasant time to visit a haunted house," Feldegast added.
As they started up the ravine, there came a sudden hideous growling from the dense undergrowth to one side of the weedy track. A huge black hound burst out of the bushes, its eyes aflame and foam dripping from its cruel fangs.
"Now you're mine,"
it snarled, its jaws
biting off the words. Tenedra screamed, and Geryon's hand flashed back over his shoulder. But quick as he was, Tzadi was even quicker. The eunuch spurred his terrified horse directly at the hulking dog. The beast rose, its jaws agape, but Tzadi hurled a strangely colored powder of about the consistency of coarse flour directly into its face.